We are here, as I said just now, to celebrate the 100th anniversary of the opening of this building. We are not celebrating the anniversary of the formation of the church, but we are specifically and primarily concerned about the building. Of course, we cannot possibly confine ourselves to that, because the importance of the building is, after all, what has happened and has taken place in it. But we must try to be accurate about these things. Now, some of you may have noticed that my way of announcing and referring to this meeting on Sunday seemed to contain an element of hesitation in it. And that was perfectly true. I wasn't attempting to conceal the hesitation. A question occurs to me, as it may do to many of you tonight, as to whether we are doing a right thing in doing what we are doing tonight at all. Should we be celebrating the opening of a building as Christian people? I think an interesting theological point arises in connection with that. And I want to say just a few words about it before I come to give you some of the interesting and notable facts in connection with this building and what has taken place in it during this long period of time. Now, I'll explain in a moment my reasons for having some hesitation with regard to this. My first instinct was that we should make reference to this event in a purely domestic and church meeting in September. We generally have a meeting in September when I return from my holidays, in which we meet together for fellowship and talk about certain matters. My first instinct was to do just that. But I was persuaded that we ought to go beyond that and have the kind of meeting that we're happening here tonight. Now, I have many reasons for this kind of hesitation. I'm not a believer in anniversaries at all, especially in connection with churches. I think it's been one of the regrettable developments in connection with free church life in particular, to multiply these special occasions, anniversaries, half-yearly anniversaries. Some even have quarterly anniversaries, and all sorts of other days and commemorations. Well, instinctively, all that doesn't appeal to me. And that's why we never have an anniversary here at all. However, I was a little bit helped by something that I read in a newspaper yesterday morning. The paper happens to have been the Western Mail of Cardiff. And this is what I read in the Western Mail for yesterday. They have an account there of the centenary of the opening of a most interesting and fascinating light railway, known as the Tallaght Light Railway. That was opened 100 years to yesterday, so it was being celebrated. But this is what I read. The Tallaght Railway has operated continuously since its inception and claims to be the first narrow-gauge railway in the world to be able to celebrate a century of steam operation with the two original engines still working. You may wonder what this has got to do with our meeting tonight, but wait a minute. It is now operated on a non-profit-making basis and attracts tens of thousands of holidaymakers every year. Now then, listen. At St. Cadwin's Church Towyn yesterday, that's to say last Sunday, a United Churches service of thanksgiving was held in connection with the railway centenary anniversary. 100-year-old railway truck, a stoker's shovel, a sledgehammer, and a locomotive sign bearing the words "The Centenarian" occupied a place of honor in the transept of the church. Thanksgivings were offered by the Reverend David Williams, pastor of Towyn Congregational Church, and the sermon was preached by the Reverend W.V. Audrey of Wisbech, a member of the Preservation Society and author of several popular children's books on trains and railways. Well, having read that, I was put a little bit at ease with regard to what we are doing tonight. Well, now, what is the cause, I say, of this hesitation that I had in my mind and partly perhaps in my spirit? Well, it is, of course, ultimately one's whole attitude as a Christian to buildings, to what are called even religious buildings. Now, I am free to confess that this is not an easy subject. In fact, I've always found it an extremely difficult one. You read your Old Testament and you see that a great deal of attention is paid to this. Think, for instance, of what we read about Solomon building that first great temple, and how it was to be exceeding magnifical, and all the details, and all the expert artistry, and all the care and the attention that went into the building of the temple. The temple was regarded with very great seriousness. All the best should be put into it, and it should be great and wonderful and magnificent in every respect, because it was the house of God. Now, the Old Testament, as you know, is full of that kind of attitude towards buildings in which God is worshipped. But when you turn over to the New Testament, you tend to find something different. You find our Lord preaching, sitting in a boat, or sitting on the side of a mountain. You read about the church in so-and-so's house. The whole picture seems to have changed completely. And therein, I think, the problem arises. Then, of course, as you come down in the history of the centuries, you find that a development took place from that simplicity that is so characteristic of the New Testament. A tendency began and arose and developed to go back, as it were, to the Old Testament idea, until you arrive at the great medieval churches and abbeys and cathedrals and so on. Now, there, I think, is this interesting question, this problem. How do we reconcile all these things? And then you remember that, Father, when you come to the 17th century, and the Puritan movement becomes powerful, you get a new attitude again appearing with regard to these buildings. You get a reaction coming in against cathedrals and ornate buildings and painted windows and all the rest that is so characteristic of the cathedral and that type of architecture and of furnishing, and you get the Puritans going in for simplicity and plainness. And they do another thing, which perhaps to me at any rate is still more important. They stopped referring to the place of worship as a church, and they would refer to it as the meeting house. Now, this, you see, is the Puritan tradition, that the building is just a meeting house. Those of you who've read any of the history of Quakerism will know how George Fox, one of the extremists in the Puritan movement in particular, used to denounce those steeple houses, as he called them. And that was, in general, the tendency with all the Puritans. They reacted against all the medieval development, which was taken over, of course, by the Church of England and continued by it, and they went in for meeting houses. All you needed was a building where men could meet together to pray, to listen to the preaching of the word, and have fellowship together, and above all, of course, meet with God. Now, I mustn't keep you with all this tonight, because we have announced that what we are going to do chiefly is to give a little bit of the history to you. But I couldn't do that without trying to justify what we are doing. Now, is there some way of reconciling all these things that I've put before you? Well, it seems to me that the best we can say is something like this, that there is no absolute rule in these matters, and that the problem isn't as simple as it sometimes appears to be. You get your two extremes in this matter. But I feel that both extremes are wrong. All we can safely say, I think, is this, that there is a danger always in externalizing our worship. It not only applies to buildings, it applies to music, it applies to art, it applies to many other things in connection with our worship of God. And the danger is, I say, to go to one extreme or the other. And that arises, of course, because we are still in the flesh. And because it does seem to be a rule, as far as one can tell from the reading of the history of the church, that externalizing and spirituality seem to be opposites, and that they're inversely proportional, that as people pay more and more significance to the external and to the forms, they tend to pay less and less attention to the living spiritual element in worship. Now, I'm not making absolutes of these. I'm simply saying that it behoves us to be careful. We can go wrong at both extremes, because the Holy Spirit of God can work anywhere. And he has worked in places that some of us with a kind of puritanical outlook would be amazed to hear about, but there is no limit to his power and to what is possible to him. Nevertheless, I think it is fair to say that, generally speaking, you have not found him working in great revival power in cathedrals and abbeys, but you have found him working in such power in the little Bethels, the plain, unadorned conventicles that have so often been despised, and often in sheds, often in caves, often on mountain tops. Now, I don't want to press this thing too far, but I think it is something that it behoves us to bear in mind. Very well. The next general remark I want to make is this. We can't possibly meet together like this evening without having a great contrast in our minds, and that is the contrast, of course, between 1865 and 1965. What a contrast. It's very difficult to imagine a greater contrast. You see, this building had to be built in 1865 because the previous building, as I'm going to tell you, had become too small. And don't forget this. This was built in 1865. It was in 1861 that Spurgeon's Metropolitan Tabernacle was built and opened. You see, within 4 years of one another, this great building and that still greater building there on the south of the River Thames. Now, that gives us, doesn't it, in a picture, the conditions prevailing in 1865. They were years of crowded churches and chapels, years of great religious success, years when almost everybody went to a place of worship, and everybody was talking about building bigger buildings. By today, the whole position has changed. The big buildings have become a problem. And when rebuilding takes place today, they're very careful to build smaller buildings. The rebuilding of the city temple, the maximum that can seat now is 1,400. That's the maximum. And the same with Spurgeon's Tabernacle rebuilt. You see, it's the exact opposite of what obtained in 1865. I was tempted sorely to spend the whole evening on the contrast between 1865 and 1965. I'm not going to do so. But it is interesting to me in this way. I've often said from this pulpit that I'm very glad that I'm preaching here now and not 100 years ago. And people have sometimes been very surprised at that. Surely, they say, you wouldn't deliberately choose these difficult, dark, discouraging days in which we live. You wouldn't sooner have that, surely, than that great condition of affluence which you've just been reminding us of that obtained in the 60s of the last century. Well, I resolutely say that I would deliberately choose to be here now rather than 100 years ago. Why? Well, I think that's the whole interesting thing about the Victorian era. It's an era of which I am a critic. I think one of the first things the Christian Church has to learn today is to forget the Victorian era and go back to the previous century, and perhaps also to the one before that. The Victorian era, to me, always seems to have been a very artificial era. It seems so prosperous, it seems so wonderful, and they were convinced it was. They were sure that they were advancing towards perfection. Even those who rejected the biological theory of evolution, they seemed to believe it, even religiously. And the church was expanding, and the missionary societies were growing and developing. The whole world was going to become Christian. And you had people holding conferences, and they didn't hesitate to say that they'd produce a plan to evangelize the whole world within a given period of time. Oh, how pathetic it all was. They didn't realize it, even in 1865, that the canker had already entered the body. They didn't realize that the higher critical movement about which they were beginning to hear, and which had come from Germany in the 30s and the 40s, was already beginning to undermine the whole situation. They went on with their optimism, and they went on with it indeed until 1914. And then, or soon after, it began to be obvious to most people that it was quite artificial, that there was a rottenness at the center. But by today, that's obvious to everybody. And that's why I prefer to be here now rather than 100 years ago. We now know exactly what we are facing, what the position is. We've got no illusions. I trust at any rate that this is true of all of us who are here tonight. We are facing reality, and not some artificial painting, which really was rotten in a sense at the very center. So we could have spent our time very profitably, I think, in drawing and painting the contrasts, the great contrasts between 1865 and 1965. Now keep that kind of thing in your mind as we now come to the actual facts of the history in connection with this place. The history of the origin of this church, for some extraordinary reason, is enshrouded in a kind of mystery. I don't know why. I've read many times of a nonconformist place of worship in Westminster in the 18th century, but it's very difficult to discover where exactly it was. So that all we seem to know is this, that a church was formed here on May the 6th, 1841. Actually, the church was incorporated a little before that. But at any rate, they built a chapel here, which was opened on May the 6th, 1841. That chapel seated 1,500 people. Now, that was their first chapel. It is said that it was built here on the site of the old Westminster Hospital. Again, people are in considerable doubt as to what that means. Some people think that that is the present St. George's Hospital, which was originally called the Westminster Hospital. However, it is a fact that there was a hospital on this site, and it was known as the old Westminster Hospital. Well, that building was opened here on May the 6th, 1841, and it seated 1,500 people. Now, at that point, the church hadn't got a minister. But in the next year, 1842, they called a minister whose name was Samuel Martin. He was a minister, a congregational minister in Cheltenham. And he was a man with a good reputation as a preacher, and they therefore called him here. And he became the minister here in May 1842. He was a very active man, full of ideas. Immediately he started a day school and Sunday schools, a ragged school, as it was then called, for children in certain parts of Westminster, and meetings for people described as down and outs, beggars and tramps and so on. He was full of that kind of activity. Indeed, what we now call the intermediate hall at the back here, the foundation stone of that was laid in 1843, after he'd been here just about a year. Well now, Dr. Samuel Martin was obviously a good preacher, and he was an excellent pastor, and a man who was full of this kind of activity. And the result was that under his ministry, this church grew rapidly and grew to very large proportions. So much so that by 1863, the building became too small. They then, of course, used to have seatings. Pews and seatings were allotted almost to everybody. And by 1863, there was a waiting list of 400 people who couldn't get seatings in the building. So it was decided in 1863 that they must have a larger building. And that is how they came to plan this present building. I could tell you many details about this and how they proceeded to do it. I don't think I need weary you with that. The fact is that on July the 6th, 1865, exactly 100 years ago to today, this building was opened. Now, this building they planned to seat 2,500 people. You see, the previous one was 1,500. They felt they must be able to accommodate 1,000 more. Those were the figures that are given. Sometimes the figure is put higher than that. Sometimes it's put lower. I've almost been persuaded at times, as I've read different people writing on this matter, that buildings can expand and contract, and that they seem to do so in terms of the particular man who happens to be the minister at the time. However, I mustn't enter into that. The building was erected to seat 2,500 people, and it undoubtedly can seat 2,500 people if they're closely packed together. Now, the cost of the building was £13,484, but having bought an extra bit of land, the total cost came to £18,000. Now, that was a lot of money 100 years ago, but that is what it cost them. Now, here is a point that I must make just now. You see the building. You're familiar with it. And you see its character. What do we say about it? Well, what we say about it, of course, is this, that it is typically Victorian. And typically Victorian nonconformity. What was happening? Well, you see, this is what was happening. And this is where nonconformity, it seems to me, went so wrong. Nonconformity began to develop an inferiority complex. Nonconformists hadn't had anything like that until, say, the 20s or the 30s of the last century. Before that, nonconformity had been proud of itself. It knew it had life was over against the established church. It knew that the Spirit of God was in it and power, and so on. And they rejoiced in it. But somewhere in those 30s, 40s, and 50s, a very subtle change took place in nonconformity. Nonconformity began to feel that she looked rather drab and rather shabby. You know, they were with their little buildings, and they looked at the great churches and the great cathedrals and the great abbeys and so on. And they felt now that they must do something about this. That after all, now they were educated people, no longer just the common ignorant people. They were now becoming prosperous financially and in other respects and were being educated, and they really must show that they were equal to the Church of England. So you begin to get a new phrase emerging. What's that? Nonconformist cathedrals. And this is one of them. Now, to me, a nonconformist cathedral is a contradiction in terms. And it is, to me, an abomination. I'm not saying that this building is an abomination to me, but I'm saying the whole concept is. Because, you see, it is indicative of a carnal spirit coming into nonconformity. A desire to be respectable. a desire to look big in the sight of the world, and so on. And there is no doubt whatsoever but that the whole design of this building, as we see it, is the result of this inferiority complex showing itself and an attempt to produce a cathedral that can stand up to Westminster Abbey. Nonconformist cathedral. Now, I was very interested, and always have been when I read this story, to observe this, that even in the time of Dr. Samuel Martin, they very rarely had to use that top gallery. It was built for him because of his successful ministry and to give this extra room. But it was not very much used, even in the heyday of those successful years and under the ministry of Dr. Samuel Martin himself. One other interesting thing is, it'll be interesting to many of you, that Mr. Spurgeon preached here, and various other famous preachers of that age preached here also. Now, Dr. Samuel Martin undoubtedly was a remarkable man, and he had a great impact upon the city of Westminster. He very rarely travelled. He believed it was his duty to spend his time here in these various activities. By about 1875, he was beginning to fail, and they had to call him in to act as co-pastor with him. And the man they called was the Reverend Henry Simon. The Reverend Henry Simon was an uncle of the man who's best known to us, perhaps, as Sir John Simon. He afterwards became Lord Simon, Lord Chancellor of England. Well, the Reverend Henry Simon was his uncle. He came from Pembrokeshire. That part of Pembrokeshire, which is sometimes called Little England beyond Wales. I don't acknowledge him as a Welshman because he came from that part, but he did actually geographically come from a part of Pembrokeshire, Little England beyond Wales. Now, the Reverend Henry Simon joined Samuel Martin here as co-pastor in 1875, but in 1878, Dr. Samuel Martin died. And here's something I want to emphasize about that. When he died, Dr. Samuel Martin was aged 61 only. Why do I emphasize that? Well, I emphasize it for this reason, that I'm almost persuaded in my mind that it was this building that killed him. He had continual trouble with his voice and with his throat. It's not surprising. It's a very difficult building to speak in. I'll make a few remarks about that later on. But I'm sure that this man died at the age of 61 very largely because of this building. He'd been ailing and failing a great deal years before that. And eventually he died, as I say, in 1878. The famous Dean Stanley of Westminster Abbey spoke at his funeral, as did also another famous dean, Dean Farrar. He was very friendly, particularly with H.M. Stanley. And to those of you who know anything about H.M. Stanley and his works, that will be a very significant thing. Now, you've often noticed a bust in the vestibule there to Dr. Samuel Martin. It is there in memory of him. As the result of his dying, the Reverend Henry Simon became the pastor, the sole pastor of the church. And in 1879, they decided to commemorate the memory of Samuel Martin, in addition to the bust in the vestibule, by erecting this organ which is here behind me. This was built in 1879 in memory of Dr. Samuel Martin. It was built by a very famous organ builder, one of the greatest of all times, I understand, Mr. Henry Willis, often called Father Willis, because he had a son who was also expert at the same work. The cost of this, if I remember rightly, was about £1,500, which in those days, of course, was a tremendous sum of money. And they were out, of course, again on the same principle, to have one of the best organs in London. You see, everything must be the best now. You were competing with the Church of England, who had such so many centuries of start over you, but you were not to be outdone. So you get the very best possible, and Henry Willis built this organ. The people who look after it, Rushworth and Dreeper, they told us when we decided to do the present work that we ought to start putting money aside, because in 10 years' time, they said, that this organ would have to be completely reconstructed, and it would cost £15,000. Well, I'm only mentioning that for this reason. I shall not be here then, but let me say this for the guidance of those who will be there. If you do that, well, then I say you will forfeit every right to expect God to bless you. To spend £15,000 on reconstructing an organ in an age like this, I regard as nothing but sheer sin. Very well, you remember that Henry Simon came here first in 1878. He became sole pastor. He came in 1875. He became sole pastor in 1878. And he continued here until 1887. Then he resigned and left and went to a church in another part of London. Why did he go? Well, it seems to me that it was the same reason again. I think it was the building. He was tired. He was feeling the strain. It wasn't so much the congregation, I think, as the building. He was contending with another factor, another element, which is interesting for us to notice. Just about that time when he was here, the trend of the middle classes to move further out was taking place, and taking place very rapidly. Anybody who could afford to do so was pressing out to the suburbs. Mr. Spurgeon had to face the same problem. But of course, because of his outstanding qualities, his people tended still to come in. And they used to come in by trains in great crowds. There was a train which was always known as the Tabernacle Special, crowded with people going to listen to Mr. Spurgeon. Well, they hadn't got a man of the magnitude of Mr. Spurgeon here, and they were undoubtedly feeling the effects of this trend out to the suburbs. Between that, but still more important, the first reason I've given you, the strain of the building, the Reverend Henry Simon resigned. He was able to thank God, he said, that in spite of this trend to the suburbs, the congregations had been holding up very well. Now then, he went in 1887. From 1887 to 1894, this church was without a pastor at all. They tried many men. Not a man would accept the invitation. Why not? Well, I think I'm still giving you the same explanation. This building. Men had known what had happened to Dr. Samuel Martin, what was happening to Henry Simon. They saw the strain upon one's physical resources, and also this trend to the suburbs to which I've referred. And the result was that many famous preachers, who were not only invited here, but on whom considerable pressure was put to come here, they wouldn't come. So that for 7 years, the church was without a settled pastor. Then in 1894, a man of the name of the Reverend W. E. Herndall, he accepted the invitation and he became the pastor here. He seems to have been a remarkable man, and I think would have done very well here, but unfortunately, within a year, he was killed in an accident. So that again leaves the church without a pastor. Then in 1896, they called another man who accepted the invitation, the Reverend Richard Westrop. He seems to have been a remarkable man, strange man in many ways. The descriptions of him tell us that he held very advanced socialistic views. As far as I can make out, his position was very similar to Lord Soper. I beg his pardon. He at that time seemed to hold those views. And he preached them and did his utmost to put them into practice here. And he was here until 1902. But it wasn't a successful ministry. In spite of his attempt to appeal to the men in the street, the modern men, with his political preaching, it wasn't a success. And he ceased in 1902. Now, from 1878 onwards, there was a good man working in connection with this church and doing an excellent work of the name of A.W. Hewitt. That's the father of the Mrs. Hewitt, who are here tonight, and Mrs. Cager, and the father-in-law of Mr. A.W. Cager. He was the official evangelist in this church, and he did great work here in the city of Westminster in connection with mission work and so on, the kind of work that you would expect an evangelist to do. He was here from 1878 until 1916, and a man who was honored by all who knew him. There is a photograph of him hanging on the wall in the Institute Hall, where he richly deserves to have his place with the various men who have been ministers of this church. However, in spite of his work, and in view of the other things I've been describing to you, this place went down from bad to worse. A most serious decline took place. We read that the services were attended by just a handful of faithful old saints, and young people were absent almost entirely. I read that only 185 members were to be found in regular communion. By 1903, this place was described by Dr. A. E. Garvey, the principal of one of the Congregational Theological Colleges. He described it as the white elephant of Congregationalism. The place was described as dirty, dilapidated, and almost deserted. And there was a very strong body of opinion in the Congregational Union that this building ought to be sold, that with the money they'd get for the site and so on, they'd be able to build large numbers of chapels in the suburbs. It was felt that it was wrong to go on maintaining a building such as this. It had had its day, it had served its purpose, and it was wrong to continue with it. That was the official view taken. But there were still some who felt that this must not happen. But it very nearly did happen. And it undoubtedly would have happened but for one thing. It was felt that there was only one man who could do anything here at all. And that one man was George Campbell Morgan. He came here and preached, and it was still more evident that he was the man. So they invited him. He accepted the invitation to come, but wasn't able to come owing to commitments in America for 6 months. But he eventually came here and started his first pastorate in November 1904. Now, he was a man, of course, who had many advantages in many ways, apart from his natural gifts as a speaker and as a teacher. He was very well known. He'd been associated with the work of D.L. Moody, particularly in America, and had become, in a sense, a world-famous person. So that when he came here, people knew about him. And he not only preached here, he began his famous Bible school, which he held on Friday nights. Now, I ought to say this, that when he came, he decided at once that the whole place must be reconstructed. And it was reconstructed. It was he who built this particular rostrum. The previous pulpit was a smaller one. But he wanted this large rostrum. Why? Well, in his Bible class, he used to have a blackboard here, and he used to put his main headings on that board, and he wanted room. He liked having people with him in the pulpit, and he felt it was to be a great evangelical center. So he established this rostrum. A friend of his became his colleague, the Reverend Albert Swift. Now they not only preached and had a Bible school on Friday night, they started a kind of institute in the premises at the back, where there were thriving meetings of all descriptions. There were lectures and classes on literature and art and drama, almost everything. A highly organized institutional church, which obviously appealed to many young people. And it was a very flourishing effort. And all that went on right until the outbreak of the First World War. Now, I think I ought to say this, because to me it's a very interesting historical point. Dr. Morgan told me more than once that if he had his time over again, he would never have started the Institute. Why, I said. Well, he said it produced a church within a church. And that is why, he said, he would never do it again. But he did it, and he did it with great thoroughness. There was a large number of sisters here, appointed deaconesses, and they did various works, visiting in the area, holding meetings for women, etc. It was a thriving place of activity, a hive of activity. And all this went on until the outbreak of the First World War. That, of course, came as a very great problem. But Dr. Morgan continued. He then, unfortunately, got an attack of typhoid fever, which, of course, laid him out. There was very little that could be done for typhoid in those days. He was seriously ill. He eventually recovered, but he never seemed to recover his strength fully. And that plus, again, I have no doubt at all, this building. Even with his extraordinary voice, a naturally powerful voice, the whole thing became a burden to him and a strain, with the result that in November 1917, he resigned from the pastorate of this church. In other words, he'd been here for 13 years. Then in 1918, a successor was invited and called, and he accepted the invitation. The famous Dr. John Henry Jowett, who'd been famous as minister of Carr's Lane in Birmingham, and after that had become equally famous as the minister of the Fifth Avenue Presbyterian Church in New York City. I again give you a detail which will give you some indication of how times have changed. When Dr. Jowett was called here, in addition to the call sent him by the church, King George V sent him a personal message pleading with him to come back to this country. That was done, of course, at the suggestion of the then Prime Minister, Mr. Lloyd George, who himself was a nonconformist, and they felt it would be a good thing for the country. You see, the lesson had still not been learned. There was a feeling abroad that after the war, now, we really were going to make a new world. And Dr. Jowett was felt to be just the man for the occasion. He was politically inclined. He was very interested politically. And he was a great favorite with politicians. And so this request and invitation was reinforced by a word from King George V. And Dr. Jowett came back. Now, Dr. Jowett, I read in his biography, didn't like this building at all. In fact, he disliked it very actively. He compared it to Charing Cross Station. I don't agree with him in that, but he disliked it. And he disliked this rostrum very much. He disliked it so much that he had them to drape it in. He said that when he stood in this pulpit as it is now, that he felt exactly as if he were standing naked in the middle of a field. You good friends have no idea as to what it's like to stand in this pulpit. It can be a most terrifying place. Well, that is how Dr. Jowett reacted. He got them to drape it in. He also got them to cover in those windows at the back. He was troubled by seeing people standing in the vestibule during the early part of the service. He was also greatly troubled by the empty top gallery. Of course, when he first came back with all this excitement, the top gallery was full. But it didn't remain full. After some 6 months, the top gallery became empty. All that, remember, in 1918-1919. People have often said to me, why can't we get this top gallery full? Well, you remember, Samuel Martin didn't. Dr. Jowett didn't. Well, there it was. He came, but unfortunately, he soon became a victim to pernicious anemia. And the result was that he had to resign in 1922. Again, the pastorate was vacant. The next man invited was a Scotsman of the name of Dr. John A. Hutton. He came here in 1923 and remained here until 1925. Now, I often listen to him. I think I listened to him most of the Sunday mornings that he was here. I was a young medical man at the time, and this man's preaching appealed to me tremendously. He was a most effective preacher. But his congregations went down and down and down. Why? Because people couldn't hear him. He had a bad habit of dropping his voice, and if you do that in this pulpit without these gadgets that are in front of me, you just can't be heard. And he couldn't be heard. However, he was invited to become the editor of the British Weekly in 1925, and he accepted. So again, the church became without a pastor. The next man invited was Dr. Hubert L. Simpson, who came here in 1928. And he exercised his ministry here. He wasn't able to build it up again, but he held Dr. Hutton's congregation and perhaps added to it somewhat. But he again soon became an ill man and a sick man. Whether it was the building again or not, I don't know. But this is a fact. So that by 1933, Dr. Campbell Morgan was invited to come back here and to join Dr. Simpson in the pastorate. They became co-pastors or associate pastors of this church. Dr. Morgan accepted. He'd been now, you see, in America since about 1918, 1919, and he came back, and they had this joint ministry. They had immediately a renovation, a kind of restoration fund of £7,500 was raised, and this building was put in order once more. Dr. Simpson's health finally failed altogether, and he had to resign in 1934, so that during 1935, Dr. Campbell Morgan was here alone again as the sole pastor of the church. But his strength now also began to fail. He began to have trouble in entering the pulpit owing to rheumatism and various other evidences of weakness, so that he was no longer able to preach more than once on a Sunday. And they began to invite other men to take the other service. And they went on like that until September 1938. And in September 1938, it was my privilege to come here. Now, my coming here has one or two points, I think, which will interest you. I mention these things because they've obviously played a large part in my life, and I don't pretend to be able to understand one of them. I shall never forget reading in a newspaper at breakfast one morning at the end of 1932, just a little paragraph, in which I read that Dr. Campbell Morgan was coming back from America to join Dr. Hubert Simpson in the pastorate of Westminster Chapel, and that he was going to start at the beginning of 1933. I read that quite casually. As I read it, I had a strange and curious intimation. It was more than a kind of intuition. I call it an intimation. It was so definite that I called the attention of my wife, and I read the paragraph out to her. I said, "Now, you may think that I'm going mad, but I am telling you here and now that this has got something of vital importance to do with me." Well, the thing, of course, appeared to be sheer lunacy. I'd never met Dr. Campbell Morgan, and there was nothing further from my mind than leaving the church where I was ministering in South Wales. However, as I read the paragraph, that is what happened. My wife is a witness to this. That was at the end of 1932. I was taking part in a meeting in the Albert Hall in December 1935. And strangely enough, it was the night when the old Crystal Palace burnt down. Again, an important life in my little story. And curiously, one of the odd connections in my life and ministry with fire, literal fire. That night I was speaking in the Albert Hall. Crystal Palace burned down, But it proved to be a turning point in my story. Dr. Campbell Morgan had come to the meeting. I'll never forget how he frightened me before the meeting. It was a typical December night, about December the 6th, if I remember rightly, and there was quite a nasty fog about. And he came on to me before the meeting, and he said, "I tell you in the presence of my Maker that no one and nothing would have made me come out on a night like this but you." And of course, I was already feeling a little bit nervous about speaking in the Albert Hall, and how I survived that, I don't know. However, that is how it happened. And the sequel was, that was a Tuesday night. Thursday morning, I had a letter from Dr. Campbell Morgan asking me if I could preach here the last Sunday of that old year, 1935. I accepted, and I came. And I preached for the first time in this pulpit on the morning of the last Sunday of December 1935. I preached both morning and evening. Then the next interesting link between us happened in 1937. I was in America giving some addresses at the General Assembly of the Presbyterian Church in the USA, and they'd arranged a preaching tour for me, and I arrived to preach in the city of Philadelphia. There was a heat wave on, unfortunately for me. It was in June 1937. I'd been driven in a car most of the day from a place called Scranton, and I was feeling completely exhausted. I arrived at the house of a minister, and as he received me, this is what he said to me. He said, "Well, I don't know what sort of a congregation we can expect tonight. It's very hot, as you know, and people are away." He said, "I don't know what sort of a congregation we are going to get, but this I do know," he said. "I can tell you who will be the most important person in the congregation." I said, "Who's that?" He said, "Dr. Campbell Morgan." He said, "He arrived last night from England with his wife. They're staying with his son, and the moment he heard that you were preaching here tonight, he said, I'm going to be there." And of course, we went into the meeting, and there he sat in front of me. And again, he was the last man I wanted to see. But he did a thing very characteristic of him, which put me right. As I was taking my text, I could see him through the corner of my eye taking out his watch. I saw he was going to time me. And that, somehow or another, helped me and stimulated me. Well, that was an important night in this way. Mark you, he preached himself as long as I do. And he would have said that any preacher worth his salt always does so. However, the importance of that occasion is this. When I finished preaching and went down, he was the first man to come to speak to me. And then, having spoken, he was leaving, he was going out. Other people were there speaking to me. As I was talking to them, I could see him walking up a kind of side alleyway. And he'd stop every now and again and turn back and look at me. And he'd walk on, then he'd stop again and he'd look again. I knew exactly what was happening, and I was right. He decided there and then to send me an invitation to join him here. He was only able to preach once a Sunday now. Would I consider coming and preaching the other end of the day? Well, I wasn't ready for that at that time. That was June 1937. I did preach here in June 37. He sent a message back. I received an invitation and I preached here again. But there was still no thought of ever coming here. However, towards the end of 1937, I myself was a little bit overtired through sheer overwork. And not only that, there was a proposal in the denomination to which I belonged, the Presbyterian Church of Wales, to send me to give some lectures on preaching and so on in one of their colleges. But there wasn't an opening until 1939, the session beginning in September 1939. Well, I was disposed to accept this, but I also felt I needed a little bit of rest. Dr. Morgan somehow or another heard all this, and again he sent me this invitation. He said, "While you are taking a bit of a rest, why not come and join me? We'll share the ministry. You preach one end of the day and I'll preach the other." Well, this suited me very well, so I accepted. And I came here as a kind of permanent pulpit supply, no more. And I never intended it to be any more. I was willing to accept this invitation to become a teacher, a lecturer, professor, whatever I might have been called, in this theological college. However, after I'd been here a very short time, Dr. Morgan, I used the word deliberately, engineered that the church meeting should extend to me an invitation to join him in the joint pastorate. And I was given that invitation in October 1938. I didn't accept it until April 1939. And then I did. And then Dr. Morgan and I went on together like that. Well, then, of course, in September 39, the war came. And it was a period of great trial. You see, we had no protection here at all. Nothing underneath, such as they have in other buildings. And there was evacuation, and people were scattered all over the place. Dr. Morgan was most troubled. He said, I've brought you here, and this is what I've brought you to. He was very troubled about this. And he said, of course, he said, we're almost certain to be bombed completely. He said, there we are so near Buckingham Palace, it's only a matter of days, probably, until this building will be completely demolished. He said, and you and I will be out of work and without a pastorate. And now again, one of these extraordinary things happened. I'm not one of those people who is given to what are called hunches or intimations or a strange feeling. I'm not that kind of person at all. I'm as far removed, I think, as possible from being psychic in any sense. But when Dr. Morgan said that to me, I was able to answer him with complete confidence. I said, this chapel will not be bombed. He said, you're very sure, aren't you? I said, I am absolutely sure. He said, how do you know? Well, I said, I can't explain it to you. But I have received an intimation that this chapel is not going to be destroyed. And he was most impressed by this. I was so sure, I was so confident that this was going to be the case. Well, on we went, and we had that first bombing. Nothing happened, but I'll never forget a certain morning, May the 11th, 1940. I'd traveled up to Oxford the day before, May the 10th, because I was due to preach in the chapel of Mansfield College in Oxford on the Sunday morning. And then I was going to travel back in the afternoon and preach here at night. I was staying with the then principal of Mansfield, Dr. Nathaniel Micklin. And we'd gone to bed at night. And the next thing I remember was I was awakened in the morning. Dr. Micklin had brought me up a cup of tea. And as he handed me the cup of tea, he said, now look here. He said, I'm going to announce this morning in the service that you'll be preaching at night as well as in the morning. I said, but you mustn't do that. I said, I'm preaching in Westminster Chapel tonight. My dear man, he said, you will not be preaching in Westminster Chapel tonight. Why not, I said? He said, there is no Westminster Chapel. I said, what do you mean? Well, he said, there's been a terrible raid last night, the worst we've ever had. And it was, actually, the last of the great night bombings of London. He said, I've heard on the wireless that the whole of Westminster is practically flattened. So he said, why not preach here tonight? Now look here, I said, listen to this. I am telling you that Westminster Chapel has not been demolished, and that I shall be preaching in it tonight. He, again, was equally amazed at this. He said, but it's ridiculous. I said, I am telling you this. Well, I didn't allow him to make the announcement that I'd be preaching at night. I preached in the morning, I got my train, I'll never forget this. I remember coming up from Ealing Broadway to Paddington, and I could see fires burning both sides of the line. I got out of the train, great queue for taxis. At last I got one. Where for, sir, said the taximan. I said, I want a chapel called Westminster Chapel, halfway along Buckingham Gate. My dear sir, he said, you can't get into Buckingham Gate. Why not? Oh, terrible bombing, he said. Everything flattened. I said, now look here. You get down in the direction of Victoria and I'll guide you. I decided to bring him along Palace Street and to turn in here into Castle Lane. And while all this was going on, he was telling me about what he'd seen, and I was absolutely certain that I'd be preaching in this chapel. I'll never forget it. We came round the corner from Palace Street into Castle Lane. I looked, and here was this old building standing as if there hadn't been a raid at all. I believe I'm right in saying that two little window panes on that side were cracked, and that's all that had happened. And I preached here and took the service as usual. Well, however, In 1944, when the flying bombs came, we did have a little bit of trouble. That bomb dropped on that block of flats the other side there one morning, and it blew off half the roof of this building. It shattered all the windows on that side. But this was the remarkable thing. As regards this building as an auditorium, it was perfect. The organ was entirely undamaged. The only thing that had happened was that all those windows were out practically. That wall had been moved an inch and a half out of position, and the main joist had been moved, and half the roof was off. Eventually, of course, we had to face this whole question of putting this building back into order. But that brings us to the end of the story as regards this building and some of the things that have happened in it.
And it was here that Dr. Martin Lloyd-Jones brought to an end his history of Westminster Chapel. The doctor himself went on to complete a very successful ministry at the chapel, which lasted until his retirement in 1968. He died on March the 1st, 1981, St. David's Day. Today his ministry continues around the world through radio, books and recordings of his many sermons given over the years at Westminster Chapel and elsewhere. For further information on these materials, please write to us here at the Martin Lloyd-Jones Recordings Trust, P.O. Box 153, Ashford, Kent, England, TN24 8WE.
We do hope that you've been helped by the preaching of Dr. Martin Lloyd-Jones. All of the sermons contained within the MLJ Trust audio library are now available for free download. You may share the sermons or broadcast them. However, because of international copyright, please be advised that we are asking first that these sermons never be offered for sale by a third party. And second, that these sermons will not be edited in any way for length or to use as audio clips. You can find our contact information on our website at mljtrust.org. That's mljtrust.org.